So it's the 30th of October 2016. It's Diwali Day in Sandton, South Africa. So that we'd spend half the class on Ramlila and half the class on Krishna Lila. Is that all right? This is illusory microphone. Looks like a microphone, but it doesn't do anything. Okay. There we go. Good. So, thought we'd read from Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 10, starting with text 32. After giving Vibhishan the power to rule the Rakshasa population of Lanka for the duration of one kalpa, Lord Ramachandra, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, placed Sita Devi on an airplane decorated with flowers and then got on the plane himself. The period for his living in the forest having ended, the Lord returned to Ayodhya accompanied by Hanuman, Sugriva, and his brother Lakshmana. 33. When Lord Ramachandra returned to his capital, Ayodhya, he was greeted on the road by the princely order who showered his body with beautiful, fragrant flowers, where great personalities like Lord Brahma and other demigods glorified the activities of the Lord in great jubilation. 34. Upon reaching Ayodhya, Lord Ramachandra heard that in his absence, his brother Bharata was eating barley cooked in the urine of a cow, covering his body with the bark of trees, wearing matted locks of hair, and lying on a mattress of kusha. The most merciful Lord very much lamented this. When Lord Bharata understood that Lord Ramachandra was returning to the capital, Ayodhya, he immediately took upon his own head Lord Ramachandra's wooden shoes and came out from his camp at Nandigram. Lord Bharata was accompanied by ministers, priests, and other respectable citizens, by professional musicians vibrating pleasing musical sounds, and by learned brahmanas loudly chanting Vedic hymns. Following the procession were chariots drawn by beautiful horses with harnesses of golden rope. These chariots were decorated by flags with golden embroidery and by other flags of various sizes and patterns. There were soldiers bedecked with golden armor. Can you imagine that? Golden armor? Servants bearing betel nut and many well-known and beautiful prostitutes. Many servants followed on foot, bearing an umbrella, whisks, different grades of precious jewels and other paraphernalia befitting a royal reception. Accompanied in this way, Lord Bharata, his heart softened in ecstasy and his eyes full of tears, approached Lord Ramachandra and fell at his lotus feet with great ecstatic love. After offering the wooden shoes before Lord Ramachandra, Lord Bharata stood with folded hands, his eyes full of tears, and Lord Ramachandra bade Bharata with tears while embracing him with both arms for a long time. Accompanied by Mother Sita and Lakshman, Lord Ramachandra then offered his respectful obeisances unto the learned brahmanas and the elderly persons in the family, and all the citizens of Ayodhya offered their respectful obeisances unto the Lord. The citizens of Ayodhya, upon seeing their king return after a long absence, offered him flower garlands, waved their upper cloths, and danced in great jubilation. O King, Lord Bharata carried Lord Ramachandra's wooden shoes. Sugriva and Vibhishan carried a whisk and an excellent fan. Hanuman carried a white umbrella. Shatrughna carried a bow and two quivers. And Sita Devi carried a water pot filled with water from holy places. Angada carried a sword. And Jambavan, king of the rikshas, carried a golden shield. By the way, Prabhupada says that Jambavan was not a bear. He said he was some kind of a tribal king. Who was called King of the Bears. But Prabhupada says if he was a bear, Krishna wouldn't have married his daughter. He said, Krishna's not going to marry a bear. Little side note. O King Prickett, as the Lord sat on his airplane of flowers, with women offering him prayers and reciters chanting about his characteristics, he appeared like the moon with the stars and planets. Thereafter, having been welcomed by his brother Bharat, Lord Ramachandra entered the city of Ayodhya in the midst of a festival. When he entered the palace, he offered obeisances to all the mothers, including Kaikeyi and the other wives of Maharaj Dasarath, and especially his own mother, Kausalya. He also offered obeisances to the spiritual preceptors, such as Vasistha. Friends of his own age and younger friends worshipped him, and he returned their respectful obeisances, as did Lakshmana and Mother Sita. In this way, they all entered the palace. Upon seeing their sons, the mothers of Ram, Lakshman, Bharata, and Shatrughna immediately arose like unconscious bodies returning to consciousness. The mothers placed their sons on their laps. That's interesting, since these are full-grown men. and bathe them with tears, thus relieving themselves of the grief of long separation. The family priest or spiritual master, Vasistha, had Lord Ramachandra cleanly shaved, freeing him from his matted locks of hair. Then, with the cooperation of the elderly members of the family, he performed the bathing ceremony, Abhishek, for Lord Ramachandra, with the water of the four seas and with other substances, just as it was performed for King Indra. Lord Ramachandra, fully bathed and his head clean shaven, dressed himself very nicely and was decorated with a garland and ornaments. Thus he shone brightly, accompanied by his brothers and wife, who were similarly dressed and ornamented. Being pleased by the full surrender and submission of Lord Bharata, Lord Ramachandra then accepted the throne of the state. He cared for the citizens exactly like a father, and the citizens, being fully engaged in their occupational duties of Varnan Ashrama, accepted him as their father. Lord Ramachandra became king during Treta Yuga, but because of his good government, the age was like Satya Yuga. Everyone was religious and completely happy. Omar Prickett, best of the Bharata dynasty, during the reign of Lord Ramachandra, the forests, the rivers, the hills and mountains, the states, the seven islands, and the seven seas, seven islands means the seven continents of the world, were all favorable in supplying the necessities of life for all living beings. When Lord Ramachandra, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, was king of the world, all bodily and mental suffering, disease, old age, bereavement, lamentation, distress, fear, and fatigue were completely absent. There was even no death for those who did not want it. So this is the day of Lord Ramachandra returning to Ayodhya, and shows us a little bit about the love between the Lord and his devotees. Yeah. Of course, we know that Lord Ramachandra was banished for no fault of his own. In those days, banishment was akin to capital punishment for someone you didn't want to kill. You know, if there was some reason, somebody deserves capital punishment, but somehow you don't want to kill them, so you exile them. Now, today, exile doesn't make sense. I suppose you can be exiled from your country. Yeah. A country can say, okay, you can't come back into this country. They don't usually do that for citizens of the country. They usually do that for non-citizens. I don't know of any instance where a citizen is exiled from a country. But in the modern age, exile doesn't mean as much. Our communities are very fluid. But in those days, it meant quite a lot. And Lord Ramachandra was not supposed to enter any kind of city or village or anything like that for 14 years. And not for any fault of his own, but because his stepmother circumstantially became afraid and envious and started some political intrigue. And of course it's very fascinating that Lord Ramachandra didn't protest, nor did he try to counteract. Generally, if somebody harms us, and this again was a very serious harm, generally if somebody harms us without any good reason, even if people harm us with good reason, but if somebody harms us without any good reason, we seek to counteract the effect. We may seek to hurt them in return, but at least we try to stop the harm from coming to us. We usually become very bitter, we become very angry, we do something, you know. But Lord Ramachandra didn't do that. He simply accepted. And that's quite an interesting thing, considering that Lord Ramachandra is God. You know, you could say that he could take it as, oh, this person has offended me, you know, they should be punished, they should go to hell. But that wasn't his view at all. His view was fine. You know, if my mother, she wasn't even his mother, she was his stepmother. You know, if my stepmother wants this, and he even said, if my father wants this, so quite, of course, Dasarath didn't exactly want it, but I should be obedient. So this example is very astonishing and gives us some clue as to how we can respond to difficulties in life. I mean, Krishna tells Uddhava that sharp arrows that pierce the physical heart are not as painful as harsh words. And what more harsh words than to say, okay, you have to be exiled to the forest. Your brother is going to become the king and you live in the forest for 14 years. But he wasn't affected by it. So how is it that Lord Ramachandra was not affected by it? Because this is very important for us. Trying to counteract difficulties in life, King Prithu says, brings us immediately into the darkest region of ignorance. Do you all know the circumstances in which King Prithu said this? So King Prithu was trying to do 100 horse sacrifices in order to establish himself as the world emperor. But Indra did 100 horse sacrifices in order to establish himself as Indra. And he was worried that if Prithu did 100 horse sacrifices, that he would want to take over his position of Indra. So after the 99th horse sacrifice, Indra came in many disguises to steal Prithu Maharaj's horse. And each time he came in a disguise of a different holy person. And after a while, you know, Lord Brahma said, don't keep going after Indra because he's establishing all these false religions in an effort to steal the horse. But Prithu said this. He said that if you try to counteract difficulties, you actually enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't put a bandage on our finger if we cut our finger or something like that, or, you know, fix a broken tire on our car. It doesn't mean like that. But it means that we shouldn't be making an attempt to try to adjust the world so that on a material level everything goes the way that we want it. And especially in circumstances where you can't really make a proper adjustment. You know, in the case of Maharaj Prithu, he could have killed Indra. And in fact, at first, the brahmanas were going to kill Indra. They started saying a mantra that was going to drag Indra into the sacrificial fire. And Lord Brahma said, don't kill Indra. You know, that's going to cause havoc in the universe. And Prithu eventually saw that he couldn't counteract the situation without causing more of a problem. And this was a similar situation for Lord Ramachandra. If he had countered the situation, it would have set an example of children going against the authority of their parents. It would have set an example of subordinates going against the authority of their superiors. And it would have created havoc in the world. Also, it would have proved Dasara's promise to be false, which would have also created havoc, because Krishna wants his devotees to be believed. I mean, after all, when we say we're going to do something, do we have the power to do it? Do we have the power to do anything we say we're going to do? No. We have to be given that ability by Krishna. So if Krishna doesn't give his devotees the ability to fulfill their promises, then they'll no longer be known as truthful, they'll no longer be trusted. So in both of these cases, the means of counteracting the situation was going to cause more harm than the original situation, at least to other people. It might not have caused more harm to the particular person who was suffering. And this is a very good key for us as to how to act when we have obstacles in our lives. I mean, the first question to ask when we have an obstacle in our life, some difficulty in our life, is do I have the ability to counteract it at all? Do I have the means to counteract it? Am I even capable of counteracting it? And then the next question is, if I can counteract it, is there going to be some kind of consequence? Is there going to be a moral, legal, ethical, or spiritual negative consequence to my counteracting it? And if the answer to those questions is yes, then better to just accept it. And better to just say, this is the will of God. Now, of course, in Lord Ramachandra's case, he being God himself, of course, had to understand what was his will. So he had several purposes in wanting to be exiled for his own purposes. So first of all, he had his sweet Leela with Sita and Lakshman in the forest. As we know, the Lord as Krishna has his most intimate abode in a forest, yes? So Krishna is in Dwarka and he's in Mathura, but he's also in Vrindavan. And Rupa Goswami talking about the highest realms, he says the highest realm is Vrindavan. You know, the whole Mathura Mandala, higher than that are the forests of Vrindavan. Higher than that is Govardhan Hill, which we'll be worshipping tomorrow. Higher than that is Radhakund. So these are very rural, simple places. And we see Lord Ramachandra also wanted to enjoy in a rural, simple place with his consort and with his brother, which reminds us of Krishna wanting to enjoy with Srimati Radharani and her friends with Balaram and the cowherd boys and so forth. So Lord Ram has a desire to enjoy like that, not just to be the king of the world. And another reason, of course, is that he wanted to have a reason to fight with Ravana. One of the Lord's qualities is that he's dependable. And Rupa Goswami says this means that the demons know that if they follow the rules, that God's not going to punish them. Which is a very different idea than the Jews and Christians and Muslims have, where they say, if you don't believe in God, you're going to get punished, right? And not only are you going to get punished, you're going to get punished eternally. be burning in this lake of fire for all of eternity. So the Bhagavatam doesn't speak like this. Rather, in the Bhagavatam, we learn there are subterranean heavenly planets for pious demons. Yes, you all know this? There's heavenly planets for pious atheists. And there's no religious people that go there, so the atheists like that. You know, they can go to a heavenly place without religious people. And there's no sun, because generally atheistic people, they like the night. Okay? It's all artificial lights. And so they don't have any sense of time passing. Whenever I read those descriptions, I think about the descriptions I've read of Las Vegas. So in Las Vegas, inside the gambling, you know, I haven't been in a gambling casino in Las Vegas, but what I've read is inside they have lights that mimic natural sunlight so that you feel that it's daytime. And they've even, such demons, these people, they've even studied human psychology to know which fragrances are likely to make us be alert. And they pump those fragrances through the ventilation system so that the people inside who are gambling, they think it's just a 24-hour day. And so they'll just keep gambling. So the demons, their heavenly planets are like that. They don't have a sense of day and night, and they don't see the sun, and they don't have religious people around. And they have sense enjoyments equal to that of Indra. So the point is that if you're a moral demon, could you be a moral atheist? Is that possible? Of course, there's many moral atheists. And so they get to go to these heavenly planets. So the point is that Krishna's not just going to come and kill a demon or punish a demon if they're following the rules. If you're an atheist, but you have good karma, you're going to get some good result. The laws of karma are neutral, which explains why there are evil people in the world who have great material opulence, because they've done something good karmically, because God is fair. He's not. He doesn't believe in nepotism. You know what nepotism is? Nepotism is when you make your brother the vice president, even though he's useless, just because he's your brother, right? You know, or somebody gives a lot of money to your campaign, and so you make them give them a big position in the government, even though they're not qualified. So Krishna doesn't do that. He's not. That's not the way he runs the universe. You know, if you qualify for the job, you get the job. At the same time, Krishna really does want devotees and saintly persons to be in charge in the universe. He doesn't want demoniac people to have power. So what is he going to do? You know, if demoniac people follow the rules and get power, if he's going to take that power away from them, he's also going to do it according to some rules. So therefore he comes into the forest with Sita, knowing full well that Ravana would kidnap Sita, and it's totally according to the rules to get your wife back from a kidnapper. And if necessary, to kill the kidnapper in order to get your wife back. That's understood even in modern society, yes? Somebody kidnapped your wife or your kids, you know, you'd be justified in using violence and force to get them back. So in that way, Lord Ramachandra was keeping the laws of the universe. And generally speaking, God does this. You know, Krishna sometimes does things that are outside of universal law to show us what things are beyond the universe. But even Krishna generally follows the laws of the universe in his incarnation. So that was another purpose of Lord Ramachandra. Yet another purpose of Lord Ramachandra was this experience of meeting and separation between himself and Sita. So this is something that the Lord does regularly with his consorts, having this meeting and separation. And you might wonder why he does this, but all of us want a loving relationship where the love is always increasing, isn't it? Right? People fantasize when they get married that, you know, if they get married at 20, that when they're 60, they'll love each other more than they did at 20. And I'm sure that happens sometimes, but generally it doesn't. If people love each other more, they usually love each other quite differently, at least, isn't it? They usually end up loving each other more as friends when they're 60. But that's kind of the fantasy, that we want our romance to just increase and increase and increase. Generally in our relationships, things don't do that. Well, it's interesting, with Krishna's family, it said with Usha and Aniruddha, their love was always increasing. And with Priyavrata and Bahirshmati in the Bhagavatam, it also said every day their love would increase by 4 times. But that's not generally the case. But the devotees want that with Krishna. And so Krishna sets up situations so that their love is always increasing. And it may look to us from a purely external point of view that the Lord is being cruel to his devotees by coming and going and having these instances of separation. But in fact, it's simply making the love grow more and more and more and more and more. So he was also doing this with Sita. Sita intensifying her feelings of love for Ram, and Ram intensifying his feelings of love for Sita. And not only, of course, did he destroy Ravana, but because Ravana decided to have a war, that was not Ram's decision, that was Ravana's decision. Angana went to Ravana and said, please give Sita back and make peace and there won't be any problem. And it was Ravana who kept insisting on fighting, yes? And he kept insisting on fighting, even after his sons, one after another, his brothers, one after another, his whole armies, one after another, were killed. And this is the foolishness of the materialist, that even when it's obvious that they cannot control the material energy and fight against God, they don't give up. Right? And this can be our foolishness, too, that we just kind of give lip service to the idea of surrender to the Lord, but don't actually do it. You know, we somehow go on in devotional service and in bhakti yoga without full surrender. And meanwhile, back in Ayodhya during all this time, so there weren't, as far as I've never read, of any kind of messages that were going back and forth. You know, it's interesting in the Gopal Champu of Jiva Goswami, he talks about how there were messengers in Dwarka or in Mathura, and who were going back and forth between Dwarka or Mathura and Vrindavan constantly, bringing the residents of Vrindavan news of Krishna and Balaram after Krishna and Balaram left Vrindavan. But we don't hear about anything like that with Lord Ramachandra. We don't hear that messengers were going from the forest, right, back to Ayodhya. In fact, when Ramachandra, Ram, Sita, and Lakshman first crossed the Ganga and went to Chitrakoot, they were met there by Bharat and a whole entourage from Ayodhya to try to convince Ram to return. And after that, Ram said, it's best that we don't stay here because everyone knows where we are. And because everyone knows where we are, they're going to be coming constantly and visiting us. And then he went eventually to Panchavati. So it seemed that Ram wanted his whereabouts and his activities unknown to the people of Ayodhya. So they were not getting any kind of messages. Right? They were just there for 14 years. So if we can try to imagine this for a minute, if we can try to imagine that we have the personal association of the Lord, you know, he's the king of the city in which we live, or the crown prince. You know, we watched him grow up from childhood, and he's going to be crowned the king. And then he goes to the forest for 14 years with his wife and his brother, and we have no news of him at all. You know, after Bharat returns that one time, there's no idea, where is he? You know, is he still alive? What's happened to him? What's happened to Sita? You know, in this world, sometimes when a person gets kidnapped or goes missing, people become almost crazy, isn't it? What's happened to my family member? What's happened to my friend? And they try to find news of the person and they put their pictures up everywhere. What's happened to them? What's happened to them? So it's like that. Nobody knew what was going on with Lord Ramachandra. So imagine the feeling of the people of Ayodhya. And this is going on for 14 years. And of course, Bharat, as was explained here, after he saw Lord Ramachandra, he decided that he would not exactly rule as the king. He would simply rule as the servant of the king, that he put Ram's shoes on the throne, that he was going to be the servant of the king. And he's sleeping on just kusha grass, and he was just bathing in cow urine and wearing bark and matted hair. And he was trying to be more austere than Ram was in the forest. And then the queens, you know, Posalya, whose own son and daughter-in-law, only son and daughter-in-law, had been exiled to the forest, and Sumitra, who one of her, Lakshman, had been in the forest. And of course, Lakshman's wife, whose husband had gone to the forest. And then what to speak of Kaikeyi? I think the person who was in the most grief and agony was Kaikeyi. So she realized very quickly that what she had done was sinful. But because Dasarath had already died, there was no question of reversing it, right? Bharat said, let's reverse it. And Ram said, you can't. You know, this was my father's promise, and he's gone. He's the only one who could revoke it, and I don't have the authority, he said, to revoke my father's promise. So Kaikeyi went through great agony and she was to a large extent shunned by the other residents of the palace and by the people of Ayodhya in her grief and in her guilt and her shame. And going on like this for 14 years without any news whatsoever, and the agony, you know, and the people count, you could just imagine just counting the days, right, until Ram's going to return. So of course when Ram actually came, and when he came it was much better than expected. I would imagine that everybody would have expected Ram, Lakshman and Sita to arrive on foot. They had been taken by Sumantra in a chariot and then dropped off on the side of the Ganga in the village of Guha, and people expected they were going to walk back into the capital, but instead they came on a celestial flower airplane, the airplane of Kuvera, that had been owned by Ravana. And they didn't come alone. They came with Vibhishan and Sugriva and Hanuman and Angada, as we were just reading about in the Bhagavatam. You know, with what a story to tell. Yes, what a story to tell of all their years of adventure and the demons that they killed, Virad and Kadamba and the sages that they met and so forth. So it was such a wonderful, festive occasion to receive Ram. So in a really esoteric sense, all of us conditioned souls are more or less in this situation. We have exiled Ram from our heart for no reason of his, just because of our own envy, that we wanted to play at being the center of the universe. I mean, after all, Kaikeyi wanted Bharat to be king, so she could be the center, you understand? So we want to be the center, and therefore we tell Ram to get out of our heart. And we don't understand that when he leaves, he also takes Sita. He also takes Sita, of course, is the personification of all opulences. She's Lakshmi Devi. So we think we're going to get wealth, fame, strength, knowledge, beauty, and renunciation on our own, but there she goes with Ramachandra. As soon as Ram goes, Sita goes. And also Lakshman, who of course is Balaram Nityananda, the guru. So the knowledge and wisdom also go to the forest. And we are left alone, and we are left bereft with an empty heart. And it's trying somehow or other to be happy without the Lord. And when finally he decides to return, when he decides that we have been just like Kaikeyi when she was finally purified of her offense, he decides to return, then what a festival we should have, yes? So this is a festival that we have of also asking Ram to return to our heart, asking the Lord to come back with Sita and Lakshman to live in the city of our heart and to light up our own lives with love and with knowledge. That this is the way that we should be chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. This is, in fact, the way we should be living. Srila Prabhupada would often say that we should be chanting, we should be living with a deep feeling of separation. You know, generally, we don't feel any separation from the Lord. We just kind of go about our lives. Oh yeah, there's a God somewhere. Hopefully I'll see him someday. But we don't really miss him. You understand? Imagine how he feels. So even in ordinary life, if some family member is away, we say to them, I miss you, right? What does that mean, I miss you? It means we're thinking about them. It means that we're thinking about their activities. We're thinking about what we did with them. We're thinking about their qualities. We're thinking about what we will be like when we meet them again, what we will do with them when we meet them again. Isn't that a fact? So this is how we should be thinking about Krishna. And thinking about Krishna like this is really the essence of Krishna consciousness, and that is the essence of what purifies us. It's not exactly that our external rituals are what's purifying us. That's not exactly the case. The external rituals do have power in and of themselves if done just externally. It's called agyata sukriti. But the point of bhakti is that we actually have some feeling, that we have some awareness, as Krishna told his father, that sacrifice is done, well, we'll be studying tomorrow, that sacrifice is done with knowledge have much more effect than sacrifice is done without knowledge. So this is the essence of bhakti, is to always feel the separation of the Lord and to be planning to welcome him back into our lives. I also like to think about Shabari, who is the tribal that Ram found in the forest. I like to think about her since by Vedic standards I'm a tribal. I mean, by modern standards, I was born in New York City, so I come from a, you know, civilized background. but by Vedic standards, I'm just a tribal. And Shabari, although she was initiated disciple of Matangi, still some of her tribal culture was still evident. Yes? So I see the same with myself. Some of my tribal culture is still evident. So what was very nice is when Matangi, her guru, left the planet when he passed away, she wanted also to leave. In fact, Prabhupada says in the fourth canto, when the spiritual master leaves, if the disciple cannot serve the mission of the guru, the disciple should also be prepared to give up their life. He says, if you don't give up your life literally, you give up your life in terms of you dedicate your whole life to the guru's mission. So anyway, she wanted to leave also. And Matangi said, no, you have to stay because Ram and Lakshman are going to personally come and visit your hermitage. So she was so excited by this and so much faith in the words of her guru that every day she would decorate her hermitage. See, the residents of Ayodhya, they were pretty sure what day Ram would return because he was exiled for 14 years. And they had great, astronomers, astrologers who could calculate exactly was the day that he was supposed to return. But Shabari didn't have that. She was just told by her guru, Ram and Lakshman are going to come. And this is something like the assurance we have from Srila Prabhupada. Just chant Hare Krishna and one day you'll see Krishna face to face. But he doesn't say which day, He doesn't say, well, it's going to be Sunday, October 30th, 2016. Right? He doesn't say that. He just says, someday Krishna will come and you'll see him. But you don't know when. Right? So Shabari was having kind of a Diwali celebration every day, waiting for Ram to come. Right? She was decorating everything with flowers and lamps and she was picking fruit and every day she was preparing for him to come. Now for most of us, if we were doing that, we would get bored and give up after a while. Those of you who came to the Manushiksha seminar, this is the pratijanu, the being patient life after life. So for most of us, okay, chant Hare Krishna and you'll see Krishna face to face. Okay, I just chanted for 3 minutes, didn't see him. I'll go to something else. For some people they give up after 3 hours, some people they give up after 3 years, whatever, they either stop the process or they just say, well, I'll just keep kind of doing it mechanically and maybe someday I'll show up. But no, Shabari had this mood that he's coming. And Srila Prabhupada was on the planet. So, he'd tell different temples he was coming. But sometimes he changed his plans. He'd tell them that he was coming. And so the whole temple got repaired and painted. And then Prabhupada had to change his plans and he's not going to come. So we should be doing this in our heart. We should be preparing for Krishna to appear. Which reminds me of the song Mama Mana Mandire by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where he says, please come into the temple of my heart and please stay there day and night. I am worshipping you, he says, with the lamplight of my love. Prema Pradipe Arati Tamara. I'm offering you the lamp of my love. So this Diwali is not just something that we do once a year because it's a Hindu festival and we're Hindus. And so we light lamps because that's what we do. Like the Christians put lamps on their trees once a year because they're Christians. It's not like that. It shouldn't be just, well, this is some sort of ritualistic thing that we do because this is our culture. But this is an external manifestation, external symbol of what should be going on all the time. That we have the light burning all the time. In our heart. We're decorating our heart all the time. Krishna, when will you come? Krishna, when will you come? Krishna, when will you come? Where are you? What are you doing? You've been gone in the forest so long. Like the gopis are saying, Krishna, you've been in the forest so long, you must be hurting your feet. And so we should have this mood. So I want to go on now to the other festival that we're observing today. Today is also the day when Mother Yasoda bound baby Krishna. And this is from the 10th canto, chapter 9, one of the last chapters that Srila Prabhupada translated and commented on. The last one was 13. So this is really very, very near the end of Srila Prabhupada's time with us. This is the very beginning of the chapter. One day when Mother Yasoda saw that all the maidservants were engaged in other household affairs, she personally began to churn the yogurt. While churning, she remembered the childish pastimes of Krishna and in her own way she composed songs and enjoyed singing to herself about all these activities. And Srila Prabhupada says that we should also do this, that we should also take Krishna's pastimes and put them to song and sing them. The only time I notice that when we do this is for the children. So many devotees have taken Krishna's pastimes and put them into song for the children. But generally the adults don't do that. Dravida Prabhu does that, if you're familiar with any of Dravida Prabhu's songs. So he's taken a lot of the verses and put them into songs that he sings. But Prabhupada isn't recommending here this just for the children. We may think, oh, that's just some childish thing. Putana was a Khechari witch, and so she could fly in the sky. Although she was evil, she entered Gokula, and everyone let her pass by. Oh, that's just a children's song. But Prabhupada is suggesting that we should all do that. Dressed in a saffron yellow sari with a belt tied around her full hips, Madhya Soda pulled on the churning rope, laboring considerably, her bangles and earrings moving and vibrating and her whole body shaking. Because of her intense love for her child, her breasts were wet with milk. Her face, with its very beautiful eyebrows, was wet with perspiration, and Malati flowers were falling from her hair. So here in the purport to this verse, Srila Prabhupada gives the essence of the practice of spontaneous love, which is what you were asking about the other day. And it's a very short purport, so we can read this. Anyone who desires to be Krishna conscious in motherly affection or parental affection should contemplate the bodily features of Mother Yasoda. It is not that one should desire to become like Yasoda, for this is Mayavada. Either in parental affection or conjugal love, friendship or servitorship, in any way, we must follow in the footsteps of the inhabitants of Vrindavan, not try to become like them. Therefore, this description is provided here. Advanced devotees must cherish this description, always thinking of Mother Yasoda's features, how she was dressed, how she was working and perspiring, how beautifully the flowers were arranged in her hair, and so on. One should take advantage of the full description provided here by thinking of Mother Yasoda and maternal affection for Krishna. So once a person's natural feelings for Krishna have awakened in a particular mood, the main change that happens in their practice of bhakti is that they meditate on residents of Vrindavan who are also in that mood. And the meditation is based, we were talking, remember about the five stages of meditation? And the first one is hearing. Some of you remember that? So we hear these descriptions of the residents of Vrindavan. Now, it's not that beginners in regulated bhakti don't also hear these descriptions. And in fact, it may be by hearing some of these descriptions that some of us awaken our feelings. Oh, yes, I want to love Krishna. I don't know if you're aware, but in 1970, Srila Prabhupada told our Jamuna Devi, our god sister Jamuna Devi, he said, you will attain all perfection by following in the footsteps of Yasoda. So clearly she had awakened to a parental rasa with the Lord. Going on here with the verses, while Mother Yasoda was churning butter, Lord Krishna, desiring to drink the milk of her breast, appeared before her, and in order to increase her transcendental pleasure, he caught hold of the churning rod and began to prevent her from churning. So this is a very charming action of a little child who can't speak very well. Right? So he just grabs the rod and keeps it from churning. So that's these particular activities of Krishna, these childhood activities of Krishna, are especially bewildering. They even bewildered Queen Kunti. They even bewildered Uddhava. How is God acting like a little child? A little child who doesn't seem to be able to walk properly, doesn't seem to be able to talk properly, and is dependent upon his mother. How is this God? So, of course, there's some pleasure in being a little child, yes? So Krishna wants to enjoy that pleasure also. They say that children laugh an average of 200 times a day and adults laugh an average of 20 times a day. You know, there's a certain sweetness in childhood, and that sweetness comes from this sort of incapability and simplicity. And what's really amazing about Krishna as a child is that he really feels like that. When Kunti says, I don't understand, Uddhava says the same thing. They say, I don't understand how you are time. You are the most fearful thing in the world. You are fear itself in the form of time. And yet you're afraid of Yasoda. How is that? And Prabhupada comments that if Krishna was just pretending to be afraid, that wouldn't be a contradiction that would bewilder Kunti and Uddhava. Anybody can understand that. You're not afraid and you're pretending to be afraid. But Krishna actually felt fear. And in this case, he felt that he couldn't communicate. That he had to, you know, who's a better communicator than God? But he feels, I can't communicate and I have to hold the churning rod in order to communicate with my mother. So who can understand this? Who can understand how God takes a position of helplessness? A human child is particularly helpless, isn't it? Yes? We were just the other day, we saw some giraffes. I saw some adult and young giraffes. I was saying how giraffes give birth standing up. The baby falls at quite a distance. Giraffes are tall creatures. The baby falls quite a distance to the ground, probably a couple meters. And the mother is indifferent and waits for the baby to stand up. If the baby doesn't stand up, she's not going to be interested in this baby. It won't make it. And the baby has to stand up. She'll nudge it a little bit to try to get it to stand up. And the baby has to start running. Within a couple hours of after birth, the baby has to start running, or that baby's not going to survive. It's going to be cheetahs and leopards and lions that will kill the baby. But the human child is very helpless, isn't it? What can a human child do on its own? Practically nothing. So why would God take this position of utter helplessness, and yet still, he's God. He's still God. I mean, he's killing Putana as a baby also. He's knocking over the cart with Sakatashara. He's killing Trinavarta. So he's exhibiting that he is God. He's not really a helpless baby. But yet he has this mood of being a helpless baby because it's pleasurable to depend on his devotees like that. It's a pleasurable exchange of rasa. And in this pleasurable exchange, he genuinely feels like that. He genuinely feels like that. He doesn't feel, I'm just playing this role. Mother Yasoda then embraced Krishna, allowed him to sit down on her lap, and began to look upon the face of the Lord with great love and affection. Because of her intense affection, milk was flowing from her breast. But when she saw that the milk pan on the oven was boiling over, she immediately left her son to take care of the overflowing milk, although the child was not yet fully satisfied with drinking the milk of his mother's breast. So Prabhupada makes a very interesting point in this purport. He says, everything in the household affairs of Mother Yasoda was meant for Krishna. Although Krishna was drinking the breast milk of Mother Yasoda, when she saw the milk pan in the kitchen was overflowing, she had to take care of it immediately, and thus she left her son, who then became very angry, not having been fully satisfied with drinking the milk of her breast. Sometimes one must take care of more than one item of important business for the same purpose. Prabhupada's talking here about priority management. Therefore, Mother Yasoda was not unjust when she left her son to take care of the overflowing milk. On the platform of love and affection is the duty of the devotee to do one thing first and another thing later. The proper intuition by which to do this is given by Krishna. So I really appreciate a lot of things at this point. First of all, that even Mother Yasoda sometimes has more than one thing to do at the same time for Krishna. Her bodily milk is for Krishna, the milk on the stove is for Krishna. What is she going to do? Of course, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that the milk on the stove was getting impatient, thinking Krishna's belly is unlimited, Mother Yasoda's breast milk is unlimited, I'm never going to get my turn. And getting impatient, it overflowed over the pot. So what are you going to do in this case? And Prabhupada says, the intuition for what to do is given by Krishna. And there's many times that Srila Prabhupada will say this kind of thing. You know, the devotee said in the beginning of the movement, Prabhupada told them to start a magazine. And they had no idea how to do a magazine. And they asked Prabhupada, how do we do it? He said, Krishna will help you. And that was Prabhupada's advice even to beginning devotees. I mean, sometimes, oh, Krishna's going to help me. First I have to be a pure devotee, then Krishna will help me. No, he's saying Krishna can help you. Krishna can give you this intuition. Now, another interesting thing about this point is Krishna became angry. Krishna became angry. So generally we say that the measure of whether or not what we're doing is successful is whether or not Krishna is pleased. Srila Prabhupada will generally say, how do you tell what you're doing is successful? Is Krishna pleased? Materially, people say something is successful if they make money, if they finish building the building, if they get some external, they get the degree, you understand? If they get some external result which they wanted to achieve. but in spiritual life, we're successful, the Krishna is pleased, even if we don't get the external result that we were trying to achieve. Like Krishna told Arjuna, fight without considering gain or loss, victory or defeat. Fight just for my pleasure. Don't worry about the external result. But here we see that Krishna is not pleased. So was Mother Yasoda successful or not? This is a very interesting case. And Rupa Goswami discusses this case in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu in terms of the definition of bhakti. And Jiva Goswami Vishwanacharya Thakura write great commentaries upon it. Because the basic definition of bhakti, does anybody know that verse? Anya bilasita shunyam gyanakama anavritam anukulena krishna anushilanam bhakti. Okay, the key word is anukulena, that which is pleasing to Krishna. Your activities have to be pleasing to Krishna. So the example is given that Kamsa gave Krishna pleasure by fighting with him. Krishna got pleasure out of killing Kamsa. And Krishna was angry at Mother Yasoda getting the milk from the stove. Does that mean that Kamsa was doing anukulena and Mother Yasoda was not? No. Kamsa did pratikul and Yasoda did anukul. Why? So this is like a deeper layer. You know, generally we think success is I achieve externally what I wanted to achieve. I wanted to build a house, I built a house. I wanted to earn money, I earned money. I wanted to complete this project, I completed this project. We say, no, success is the Krishna smells, whether the project is completed or not. But now we're saying, even deeper than that, Krishna smiling is not the answer. Because Krishna was smiling while he was beating up Kamsa, and he certainly wasn't smiling when Mother Yasoda went to take care of the overflowing milk. We say the measure is whether one intends to please Krishna. Kamsa had no intention to please Krishna. In fact, his intention was to kill Krishna. His intention was to harm Krishna. Whereas Mother Yasoda's intention was to please Krishna. You know, that milk Mother Yasoda had on the stove, that was from the very best cows. She pulled out the best cows out of the 900,000 cows that her husband had. And she fed them the very best grass, the very best. You know, Krishna would have the best milk. You don't want that milk to just go to waste and boil over, right? And how will Krishna have his milk? I remember at Gita Nagari when I was the head cook there. So one of the things I would do was make yogurt every day. So, you know, you have to get milk to a certain temperature and then you put in the culture. So I would have a metal container about this high, maybe it was five. Anyway, it was a big container of milk from our own cows. And the stove, you know, stove is about this high, right? Something like that? Yes? Then there was a big pot on top of the stove. So how high was that? I mean, it was high. And I had to pick up this metal container full of milk all the way to the top of the pot and pour it in. Obviously, I was a little younger then. So every day I managed to do it, except one day. One day, I went to pour it, and I missed. And the milk went all over the floor. Just imagine gallons of milk. And right at that moment, the head of the goshal, Devakinandan, just happened to walk into the kitchen. And he walked in the kitchen, and he saw this ocean of milk on the floor. And he looked at me and he said, "That's liquid religion." So Mother Yasoda didn't want that to happen. You know, she didn't want all the milk to be spoiled. It was Krishna's milk. That's why she gets upset when he breaks the butter pot also. Because she was going to use it to cook something. Of course, I mean, Krishna ate it and he got pleasure from eating it and giving it to the monkeys. But that wasn't quite Mother Yasoda's intention in giving it to Krishna. But because Mother Yasoda's intention was to please Krishna with this milk, that was her intention. Therefore, it's bhakti. And therefore, in an ultimate sense, Krishna is pleased. Even though he's not smiling, he's angry. So perhaps we're familiar with the different rasas. So the main rasas are a feeling of awe and reverence for the Lord, peace, a feeling of serving the Lord, friendship, taking care of the Lord like a child, or having a romantic relationship with the Lord. But there's also 7 secondary rasas. And one of them is anger. One of them is fear. And we might say, well, how are those enjoyable? But people do things to enjoy anger all the time. Political rallies are mostly so people can enjoy anger. Right?
my candidate is best and yours isn't.
In sporting events, correct? Sporting, I remember visiting a devotee's house and their son, I don't know, 2022, something like that. He was watching some sports game on the television. He was alone in the room. I had to walk like through the room to go upstairs. And as I'm walking through the room, he jumps up out of his chair and starts shaking his fist at the television and yelling at the guys on the television. But it's pleasure. If it wasn't pleasure, they wouldn't do it. Prabhupada says in the preface, Nectar Devotion, everything we do is motivated by a desire for pleasure. So people are getting pleasure out of being angry. We get pleasure out of being afraid. Yeah, people like to read books or watch movies where there's some scary part, right? It's going to happen. So these are rasas. So Krishna's enjoying this rasa. And of course, this fear and this anger are in relationship to his love for his mother. Ordinary material fear and anger is not really very pleasurable. Even material joy is, frankly, not very pleasurable. But on the spiritual platform, because Krishna's anger and fear have to do with his love for his mother, the only reason he's afraid and the only reason he's angry is because he loves his mother so much. He's not really on an ontological platform afraid or angry. You understand that? You follow? You can't say, well, what's he going to be afraid of? What does he have to be angry at? You know, that doesn't really mean anything. But because he loves his mother, therefore he's feeling these emotions, and he's enjoying these emotions. So although it appears that Krishna is not pleased, in the sense that he's not pleased like that, actually he is pleased, because he's enjoying this relationship. Being very angry and biting his reddish lips with his teeth, Krishna, with false tears in his eyes, broke the container of yogurt with a piece of stone. Then he entered a room and began to eat the freshly churned butter in a solitary place. Madhya Yasoda, after taking down the hot milk from the oven, returned to the churning spot, and when she saw that the container of yogurt was broken and that Krishna was not present, she concluded that the breaking of the pot was the work of Krishna. Krishna at that time was sitting on an upside-down wooden mortar for grinding spices and was distributing milk preparations such as yogurt and butter to the monkeys as he liked. And so we all like to distribute food to animals, yeah? Right? Is it? General activity of human beings, especially to distribute food to wild animals. I mean, pigeons are not particularly wild, I suppose, but they're not tame animals, and you go into practically any city and you'll find people distributing food to the pigeons and the squirrels. I remember when I took one of my grandsons around the world, and he lives in Hawaii where there's no pigeons, and we were in Italy, and it was the first time that he had seen, at least I'm sure he saw pigeons when he was a little kid, but he didn't remember. So the first time that he saw pigeons, he was so excited about feeding the pigeons. So even adults, we like to do this, but children especially like to do this. If you remember, do you remember when you were children? When you were a child, when you liked to feed the pigeons or the squirrels or something like that. So Krishna's having so much fun feeding the monkeys. By the way, if you go to India, it's not advised to feed the monkeys, the rhesus monkeys. They're actually quite dangerous. Langur monkeys are okay, but rhesus monkeys are really a problem. They can be quite aggressive. And once you start feeding the monkeys, I mean, if somebody thinks they're, well, you know, I'm going to be like Krishna, and I'm going to feed the monkeys, then they'll come to your place all the time, and then they'll, you know, eat your clothes on the clothesline, and they'll tear the pipe out of your water tank on top of the roof, and it's not very pleasant. They're very mischievous. But Krishna was enjoying feeding these monkeys. So he was really having a lot of fun doing that. Because of having stolen, he was looking all around with great anxiety, suspecting that he might be chastised by his mother. So again, this is a kind of rasa for him. Madhya Yasoda, upon seeing him, very cautiously approached him from behind. How do you cautiously approach God from behind so that he doesn't see you? You know, again, speaking ontologically, this doesn't make sense. Yeah, if we're just going to think about God as the all-pervasive, all-knowing being. And it's so wonderful, this philosophy we have, that God is the all-pervasive, all-knowing being. And he's also this little child who's looking around. Am I going to get caught? You know, that's our general mood in the material world, isn't it? A materialistic person is always more or less doing something wrong. And we're always worried, you know, when am I going to get found out? When am I going to get found out? So Krishna's doing this, but in its original form, in his pure spiritual form. And Mother Yasoda's trying to sneak up on Krishna. When Lord Krishna didn't work. When Lord Krishna saw his mother's stick in hand, he very quickly got down from the top of the mortar and began to flee as if very much afraid. Now, any of you who have had little children, I don't know how this works, but little children who walk and run awkwardly and whose legs are much shorter than that of adults can outrun adults. I really don't understand it, but they can, at least for some time. So it can be very difficult to catch up with even a very small child. By the laws of physics, it doesn't, their legs are only this big. My legs are this big. And they kind of walk in a funny way and still they can outrun adults, at least for some time. Although yogis try to capture him as Paramatma by meditation, desiring to enter into the effulgence of the Lord with great austerities and penances, they fail to reach him. But Mother Yasoda, thinking that same personality of Godhead Krishna to be her son, began following Krishna to catch him. Sometimes devotees say, this is a good mood in which to chant our japa, I'm going to catch you, Krishna. While following Krishna, Mother Yasoda, her thin waist, overburdened by her heavy breasts, naturally had to reduce her speed. Because of following Krishna very swiftly, her hair became loose, and the flowers in her hair were falling after her. Yet she did not fail to capture her son, Krishna, so she was successful. And it said that these flowers were falling from her hair to worship her feet. Of course, the flowers are all fully conscious. When caught by Mother Yasoda, Krishna became more and more afraid and admitted to being an offender. So he was hoping that was going to get him out of trouble. I did it, Mommy, don't hurt me. As she looked upon him, she saw that he was crying, his tears mixing with the black ointment around his eyes, and as he rubbed his eyes with his hands, he smeared the ointment all over his face. So this is another charming thing that children do, right? They make a mess. Right, is it? If children aren't making a mess, they're probably sick. This is what they do. So he's, you know, he had this black ointment in his eyes, he's rubbing this black smears all over his eyes. Mother Yasoda, catching her beautiful son by the hand, mildly began to chastise him. Mother Yasoda was always overwhelmed by intense love for Krishna, not knowing who Krishna was or how powerful he was. Because of maternal affection for Krishna, she never even cared to know who he was. Therefore, when she saw that her son had become excessively afraid, she threw the stick away and desired to bind him so he would not commit any further naughty activities. This, of course, reminds us of Jagannath Mishra with Lord Chaitanya. And one time Jagannath Mishra says he severely rebuked his son. Really, you did the wrong thing. That was terrible. Don't do that again. And then that night he had a dream that a Brahmin came to him and said, what are you doing? Your son is Narayan. Why are you correcting him? And so harshly. And Jagannath Mishra said, I don't care who he is. He says, he's my son, and therefore I have a duty to correct him. Otherwise, how will he grow up nicely? So again, from a purely logical position, this doesn't make sense. If your son is God, you don't have to train him. You don't have to correct him. But this is the understanding given in the Vedas, that God has these playful pastimes with his devotees, where the devotees and the Lord both forget that he's God, and they deal with him very intimately. You know, even very famous or wealthy or influential people on this planet want to be in such a position. It's, you know, people want to be famous and they want to be rich so that people will respect them and they'll have power, but it gets boring and tiring. You understand? Yes? They want to be with people who just treat them as themselves and forget that they are great and powerful. Prabhupada tells the story of how in Britain, there was one person who went to see the Prime Minister and was told, well, the Prime Minister is very busy, you'll have to wait. So he's waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. Then he thinks, I wonder what the Prime Minister is doing. So he goes to the door and opens it a little bit. He sees the Prime Minister is giving a horseyback ride to his grandson. You know, so Prabhupada says that the Lord is also like this. He wants to be treated in an intimate way by people who love him just for him, who don't love him because he's God, who don't love him because he's opulent, who don't love him because he's powerful. The residents of Vaikuntha, they love God because he's God. You follow? They love God, but they love God because he's God. The residents of Vrindavan, they just love Krishna because. Without some cause. Supreme Personality of God, it has no beginning and no end, no exterior, no interior, no front, and no rear. In other words, he is all-pervading. Because he is not under the influence of the element of time, for him there is no difference between past, present, and future. He exists in his own transcendental form at all times. Being absolute beyond relativity, he is free from distinctions between cause and effect, although he is a cause and effect of everything. That unmanifested person who is beyond the perception of the senses had now appeared as a human child, and Mother Yasoda, considering him her own ordinary child, bound him to the wooden mortar with a rope. When Mother Yasoda was trying to bind the offending child, she saw that the binding rope was short by a distance the width of two fingers. Thus she brought another rope to join to it. The new rope was also short by a measurement of two fingers, and when another rope was joined to it, it was still two fingers too short. As many ropes as she joined, all of them failed. Their shortness could not be overcome. Thus Mother Yasoda joined whatever ropes were available in the household, but still she failed in her attempt to bind Krishna. Mother Yasoda's friends, the elderly gopis in the neighborhood, probably calls them elderly, but they weren't like 70. Means they were, 25, 30. Were smiling and enjoying the fun. Similarly, Mother Yasoda, although laboring that way, was also smiling. All of them were struck with wonder. So the acharyas say, first Mother Yasoda was annoyed, but after a while she became smart. She started to smile. And of course, again, we're looking at something impossible. Krishna has a little belt around his waist, and Mother Yasoda can't put a rope around his waist. But this is our situation if we think we're going to bind Krishna by our sadhana. Somehow I'm going to do so much austerity. We should do our sadhana, we should do austerities. Mother Yasoda had to make the effort. She had to make the effort, but her effort alone was not enough. If we think my effort alone is going to be enough, it's never going to be enough. Because of Mother Yasoda's hard labor, her whole body became covered with perspiration, and the flowers and comb were falling from her hair. When Child Krishna saw his mother thus fatigued, he became merciful to her and agreed to be bound. So that is exactly what happens in our own Krishna consciousness. I really like the story of Bhima, who was fighting with Jarasandha on Krishna's order, with Krishna standing right there. And Bhima's fighting with Jarasandha, trying to defeat him. And every day for a lunar month, for 28 days, Bhima and Jarasandha are fighting. And nothing new. Nobody's winning. Every day they fight, every night they're staying with Jarasandha as a guest, as friends, and nobody's winning. Nobody's winning, day after day after day. Even though it's Krishna's order that Bhima fight, and even though Krishna is standing right there. And it was only after a month of effort that Bhima says to Krishna, Nashaktoham Jarasandham Nirjetam Yudhi Madhava. My dear Madhava, I don't have the shakti to defeat Jarasandha in battle. And then Abhyayam Swena Tejasa, Krishna infuses Bhima with his own power, and he gives Bhima this hint by spitting a blade of grass. So I see that our relationship with the Lord is very similar. That if we just go to Krishna without making any effort, if we say, well, I'm not going to chant, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that, and you just give me your mercy, and you reveal yourself to me, it's not going to happen. But we make the maximum effort. And at the same time, we're aware that our maximum effort is nothing. We make the maximum effort, but we don't think our maximum effort buys us Krishna, or earns us Krishna, or obligates Krishna. We make the maximum effort not because we're the doer, but simply to show Krishna our sincerity. Simply to show Krishna our sincerity. And at a certain point, when he's convinced that we actually have sincerity and we have affection for him, then he meets us. As Prabhupada said, we take one step to Krishna, he takes 10 steps towards us. So he meets us much more than halfway. We really, our maximum effort is practically nothing. But when he sees that measure of our sincerity, he comes to us. So does anyone have questions or comments on either of these pastimes with duality? Yes.
with regards to Shabari,
yes,
who was having like a Diwali festival every day.
Yes.
Can one's sort of opulence by birth, particularly this this ability to like speculate and understand complicated subject matters, which somewhat like even sort of stifle the capacity to like be as simple as her. Does it like prevent one from having that pratijana?
Well, it's interesting because Kunti Devi says that as long as we're impressed with our material opulences, we cannot approach the Lord with sincere feeling. Janmai, Aishwarya, Shrutir, Shri, right? It says we have to be akinchana, we have to feel possessiveness. So what does this mean? Does this mean that we should, you know, if you're smart, you should hit yourself in the head with a hammer so that you become very simple? So I don't think so. That's not the point. Whatever opulences we have, whatever abilities we have, we should use them in the service of the Lord. The problem is more thinking that they're ours and thinking that there's some sort of spiritual qualification. That's the problem. If I think, you know, my intelligence, my money, just like, you know, we're building this temple of the Vedic Planetarium in India, so if everybody gave away all their money, how would we build it? You understand? If nobody had any money to give for the temple, how would we build it? If everybody said, well, money is an impediment, so let me just live like a poor person. You know, in the early days of ISKCON, we encouraged everyone to move into temple ashrams and to give up everything. And we really did. You know, I left university. I left after 1 year. I mean, Shiva Maharaj left university 2 weeks before he was going to graduate. He said that was hard for his mother for a long time. So, but that's what we did. You know, we just left everything. I gave my car to my father. We just left everything. We came to the temple with some little box of things. But it was very hard to build a society like that. If the measure of your sincerity in Krishna consciousness is that you give everything up, how are you going to build a temple? You follow? So gradually, in the 80s and the 90s, took us a little while, but gradually by the late 80s and the early 90s, we started encouraging people. You know, if you have a propensity for business and you can make money, maybe you should do that. And the same way, you know, there was a time when we just encouraged everyone to drop out of school and not become educated. And now we encourage people who are qualified, you know, go and get an education and become qualified, be able to use it in Krishna service. So that's a little bit more mature. So whatever tendency we have, we should use in the Lord's service. In fact, Krishna tells that to Arjuna, and he says very clearly to Arjuna, you're not going to be able to repress your natural tendencies. So all of us have abilities which, if we use them properly, are helpful in Krishna consciousness, and if we don't use them properly, are harmful in Krishna consciousness. Whatever that is. Whatever talent and ability we have, whatever inclination we have, it's a double-edged sword for all of us. It's not that only intellectual people have that problem, or only wealthy people have that problem. Everybody, probably that everyone has some extraordinary talent. So if we don't use that properly, then we have a problem. Is that all right? Anybody else? Yes, Ruru.
That was at the nature a bit earlier. One of the security guards, somebody had, he went into the temple room and he saw that big picture of Yashoda and Damodar. And somebody said that this boy is God. So he was like very much concerned about this. So while he was outside, he was asking everybody, is that boy really God? And it came through in your class, like how Krishna is God and at the same time he's this boy. But we can understand because like we have all the scriptural injunctions to understand.
Yes.
But somebody who just asks it off the street, how is this boy God? How would you recommend we put it into simple terms?
Well, the best thing would be to sell them a Krishna book. And one of Srila Prabhupada's many aspects of genius was that he was able to take these very esoteric, very confusing, very apparently full of contradictory pastimes of the Lord, and make them understandable to anybody. That we would take Krishna book and we would sell it to anybody. I mean, I read Krishna book when I was in university. It was one of, you know, one of the first books I read. I read Bhagavad Gita before that. But I didn't have any difficulty at all understanding that God could be this little naughty boy. Because of Srila Prabhupada's expert interweaving of philosophy and lila. And we find, if we look at our Gaudiya Acharyas, we find that they often didn't do that. You know, they often wrote books just assuming you already understood. They were writing for a different audience. And this is a little bit of a problem nowadays with people translating these books, and we just have them available in all of our temple shops and things like that, and there aren't explanations. So if you're not able to sell somebody a Krishna book, which is my main suggestion, then the main answer is that Krishna is Akila Rasamrita Murti, that he is the form of all kinds of pleasure, and therefore he takes the form of a small child in order to enjoy the pleasure of a small child. But he still can act as God fully in that form of a small child. It's a pleasure pastime for him. So I think that's the simplest way to explain it to people, that God can take on an unlimited number of forms to enjoy an unlimited number of various types of pleasure. And that's a type of pleasure. Yes?
Thank you, Mataji. Could you speak a bit about Yoga Maya and the personality and who the personality is and to what extent he or she gets involved in
Well, I don't know how much I know Yogamaya. You know, I haven't met her personally in this life. So I'm not sure I can introduce you to her like that. Yogamaya is the potency that when you meet her, you can tell us. But she does something very interesting in Krishna's pastimes. And that is that she has it so that the residents of Vrindavan are almost completely unaware that Krishna is God. Not completely. We have the gopis, they say, we know you're not really the son of Mother Yashoda, we know you're really the Supreme Lord, the indwelling witness in everyone's heart, and so forth. But almost completely. From a practical point of view, they don't know that Krishna is God. It's not what's operating. And their main awareness is of their role in the lila of the Lord. They experience the lilas of the Lord as an unfolding drama. I mean, we have Mahamaya in this world that does something to us like that, except that it's very unpleasant. In this world, we don't really remember who we are. And we have to live our lives as it unfolds, only from our own perspective. But that's not very pleasant. We feel confused. You know, what decision should I make? Where should I go? Who am I? What's my goal in life? Because we're covered by this. So Yogamaya is the blissful reality of that, where one's absorbed in one's personal relationship with the Lord and absorbed in one's role in the lila. Seeing the Lord simply as your friend or as your beloved or as your son or whatever. And it's a very, very sweet, sweet energy. And there's some awareness somewhere that Krishna is God. And there's some awareness somewhere of knowingness of the liberated soul. But it's not, it's way in the background. It's way in the background. I mean, a little idea of what that is, you know, the president of the country, they have their spouse, they have their children, and their spouse and children know that it's the president of the country. But when they're alone in their family quarters, they're not dealing like that. They know. It's not that they don't know, but it's way back. In the awareness, it's not. It's almost gone from the awareness. Is that okay? So thank you very much. Diwali ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.